Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
Lethal simplicity. Yeah, I like to score fast. It's hard not to be a Noles fan. Get Florida State back. I want a damn good defense. We're still undefeated. Blame no one. Make no excuses. Do something.
Everybody, welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. We're picking back up with part two of an extended mailbag. Tons of questions that I've gotten over the last couple weeks. But before we get started, once again, I want to thank Luis Marquez for his sponsorship of the show. That is Luis Marquez from Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida. Not just a realtor, but one of the best realtors and a trained photographer and videographer, which if you list a home, you definitely want someone who is trained to make your home look as good as possible online, to set you up with the best possible online marketing plan. Nobody's going to make your home look better for prospective home buyers, including smooth professional walkthrough video. And if you are thinking about listing your house, you need to give Luis a call. Information in the show notes. Mention that you heard about him through the Unconquered Podcast, and he'll include a free warranty on the home that covers repairs and replacements through the listing period. And if you're in the market to buy a home in the greater Jacksonville area, you need to go through Luis. Nobody's going to outwork the guy. I know that for a fact. Listen, he was an assistant manager at the Pickup Publix in Tallahassee. If you can be a manager at that store, you know how to work. So once again, give Luis a call. Let him know that you heard about him from the Unconquered Podcast. Definitely helps out a bunch. All right. The first question in this episode is from Preston Smith. Enjoyed your latest podcast. Can you talk about why we had so many misses with blue chip linebackers and wide receivers never missing expectation, and how Florida State will go about turning around the offensive line? Okay, so several different questions here. The first one is about why so many misses with blue chip linebackers and wide receivers never meeting expectations. So I'll deal with that one first. Well, I think the first thing is dealing with the linebackers. On the linebacker side, I'm looking down the list and I'm not seeing a ton of blue chip linebackers that they landed. Like, I go down the list. Let's start in 2012. They landed one blue chipper the year after 2012. You know, Ukeme Oligwe, you could say, is a blue chip linebacker in 2012. Aside from that, no, nobody. That's one. And then he got kicked off the team. Then you get the next year, you get, let's see, Matthew Thomas and EJ Levenberry. And then Levenberry ended up not working out real well with the new staff, and he ended up transferring. So there you go. And then you had Roderick Hoskins, who is not a blue chipper, but he lasted. Matthew Thomas was a character problem all along. And if Jimbo Fisher hadn't made a promise to Matthew Thomas's mother, effectively on her deathbed, that he would make sure that Matthew graduated, then Matthew Thomas would have probably found his way off the Florida State team within a couple years. But Fisher gave him third, fourth, and fifth strikes because he had made a promise to Matthew's mother. And Thomas, you know, took advantage of those extra strikes. And the fact that he was such a problem in all those other respects and refused to be coached and all sorts of other things made it so that the most talented linebacker that they recruited in the Jimbo era ended up being ended up not living up to expectations. Then let's see, 2014, you get Jacob Pugh as more of an edge. No blue chip linebackers. 2015, no blue chip linebackers. Your best linebacker in that class is Shamar Kilby Lane, who found his way off the roster rather quickly due to academics. Then you finally get a blue chip linebacker in 2016. You get a couple of them. You get Dontavius Jackson and Josh Ball, and they started to develop a little bit. I'm sorry, Josh Brown. They started to develop a little bit early on, but again, at that point, you already had a bad example who refused to listen to the coaches at that position and became a bit of a ringleader there. And the linebackers coach that was on the staff couldn't handle some of those issues and didn't always get the support that he needed to handle some of those issues. And so that's what you got. So that answers the linebacker side. The number one problem is they didn't bring in a bunch of blue chip kids. And then the few blue chip kids that they had, about half of them found their way off the roster within about a year. You can't do that. And then the one that lasted only because, you know, basically they gave him every possible opportunity, even though he showed his hindquarters repeatedly. So Yeah. Then you have the wide receiver position. And the wide receiver position, I mean, this horse is long dead, but the biggest thing in the wide receiver position is they very much, Fisher values size so much at every position that he really emphasized getting big, athletic bodies at the wide receiver position and then effectively teaching them to be wide receivers. And there are a few cases where he passed over wide receivers who were more ready to play early on because they didn't fit the criteria. They didn't fit the ideal, the numbers that he was recruiting to at that position once he got established. And so you had problems where they would bring in guys who were big-bodied, athletic athletes, but were not wide receivers when they arrived on campus, and they had to learn to be wide receivers in a legitimate offense that required wide receivers to be wide receivers, not just, you know, outside running backs who get screens and such. So that meant that, you know, you had a growth curve that every one of these guys was going to have that was going to be sizable. And then along with those guys, he would recruit a few slots or guys that would be special teams guys, you know, those sorts of guys, your Kermit Whitfields, your Bobo Wilsons, and so on. And you combine that with the high level of attrition at that position. Marvin Bracy, gone. John Franklin, who they really expected to switch to wide receiver, chose not to make the switch. Javon Harrison, gone. Devontae Phillips, gone. Go down the list. Who else? another one. Isaiah Jones, gone. Big-bodied wide receiver. Over and over and over again, these wide receivers would find their way off the roster, the bigger ones, and then that would leave them with either the Smurf attack that they had for a year and a half, or, again, having too little depth there. And guys that, again, were raw. Guys that had to learn to play the position. So I think those were the biggest factors. In order, the number one trick to being a great wide receiver coach in the college game is recruiting five-star wide receivers who are elite athletes who can play right away, who are already relatively polished wide receivers. If you recruit Amari Cooper and Calvin Ridley, you're a genius wide receivers coach. You're going to look like a genius. You recruit Sammy Watkins, you don't have to do much with those guys. Florida State hasn't gotten anybody like that in years. I mean, it's certain they didn't get anybody like either of the, like any of those three guys. Nobody liked that in any of the time that Jimbo Fisher was at Florida State. But again, they kept trying to get big, fast athletes and then convert them into wide receivers effectively. It's not necessarily a bad idea. By year four, year three, that guy, if you get him to, if it works, if you get George Campbell to really click at wide receiver, and to figure out how to play that position at the college level, that size speed combo, you're not gonna find many of those, but you need to find a mix. You need to take some of those guys that are guaranteed solid wide receivers on your roster, and you need to take more bodies too. I think they under recruited the position by about two wide receivers every three years. So that's another factor. You got to have more bodies. I mean, I know that the current staff at Florida State is a little surprised that the last staff didn't recruit Jashawn Jones, a kid out of Tampa, harder. Like, why didn't they recruit him? Why? Well, because he didn't fit the size speed. He didn't check the size speed boxes that they were looking for there. Even though he's going to be one of those guys that's going to go somewhere else, and he's going to be an 1,100 yard wide receiver as a second year player. You know, that's your biggest reason. And the five guys that they just brought in, ironically, are big and really fast. And actually, of them, again, Warren Thompson, Jordan Young, and Trayshawn Harrison are all better instant prospects than just about anybody that they brought in otherwise. Now, the good thing is that they have Keith Gavin, Tamorian Terry, and George Campbell, if George Campbell's, apparently they've figured it out in terms of his core injury. If his core injury stays healthy, if he's able to stay healthy, and you've got those three guys plus Nooney Murray on your roster, then you're in good shape already. And then those young guys can be the kind of instant depth that you want them to be instead of having to depend on them. And you're looking really good. So, you know, the development is there for those older guys, and they're arriving just in time to really get the payoff on that side. I mean, I think Keith Gavin's going to have a huge year next year. I mean, I was told again, he had a really, really, really good bowl prep and just didn't quite take it to the field last year. All right. Final question there was, how will Florida State go about turning around the offensive line? I think the first order business there comes down to improving the effort in the weight room and in offseason conditioning. I mean, I've mentioned previously on this show that some of Florida State's assistant coaches were not happy with the state of Florida State's strength and conditioning program. I can now name at this time one of the guys that was really upset about how things were going in the weight room and in offseason conditioning, and that was one Rick Trickett. He stayed upset that he did not believe that his guys were getting the kind of development in the offseason that they should be getting, but that's not the offensive line coach's call. He felt like he was getting guys who were fat, sloppy, and out of shape and were not strong enough and were unbalanced, weren't able to bend like they should coming out of the offseason program. And he was right. Trickett was right. I mean, I addressed that a good bit on this show about how soft Florida State looked at different points, especially coming out of the 2014 season. You'll remember, longtime listeners will remember that I was talking about, you know, this team just looks overweight and they look a little soft. And then 2015 had some of the same questions. And I started asking, you know, maybe are they being too lax with these guys with the GPS system? Starting to ask some of those questions. And then 2016, you'll remember me asking the question, and I've asked this a good bit since the 2016 season. When was the last time Florida State just showed up and out-hit somebody? Like physically, when did they just show up and just look like the dominant out-hitting team? Now, in 2017, I think they actually out-hit Alabama for the most part, and then they just fumbled that game away. So they were more ready in that regard. But overall, I don't think that the offensive line had developed and had conditioned as well as they should. Now, every time there's a coaching change, you're going to hear a bunch of stuff about, oh man, our guys are working so much harder. This new staff really, really gets it. And, you know, the new strength and conditioning program is so much better. You're always going to hear that. And for the most part, most teams basically do a lot of the same stuff in strength and conditioning. That said, that doesn't mean that it's not true. In many cases, particularly in cases where you have a turnover in staff and the new message is a breath of fresh air and kids are just working harder because they're more motivated and so on to play for the new coaches. And that happens, and that has happened at Florida State. And I do think, again, that there were some issues in the Florida State strength and conditioning system in how it was being run over the last couple of years. I heard a lot of complaints. More or less kept a lot of that stuff quiet, made my own sort of critiques on that. But I think that's the biggest place where the offensive line can really, that's the first step to turning around the offensive line. The second step is getting good quarterback play. The offensive line at Florida State was better than a lot of people realized the last couple of years. They were not awful. They were decent. But bad quarterback play, particularly a quarterback who's going to hold on to the ball forever and not get the ball out and get the ball to, you know, underneath throws and different things the way that a more experienced guy will, bad quarterback play will make an offensive line look really bad. If that offensive line is decent and you've got bad quarterback play, they're going to look awful. If it's a good offensive line and you've got bad quarterback play, they're going to look average. And Florida State was basically a decent offensive line that looked awful. In large measure because of the quarterback play. So improve the quarterback play and the offensive line is automatically going to look better. And then the third factor is they need to get and stay healthy, which is to some degree related to the strength and conditioning thing. The fourth factor is, I think, the one where Greg Fry can come in and really help, and that's with certain technical stuff. Trickett was more of an effort coach as an offensive line coach, and he was a good coach. He was a very good offensive line coach, highly respected for good reason. And Trickett really, I always felt like Trickett was a better interior offensive line coach than he was a tackle coach. I always felt like his tackles could have a little bit better technique. But at the guards and the center position, I thought he did a pretty good job. He did a really good job, usually. I think that that's the other place where, this is where Greg Fry can really shine, and that is Greg Fry played tackle, and he is one of the best tackle coaches in the country. That guy can develop offensive tackles. And Florida State has some talent in Josh Ball, in Derek Kelly, in Jawan Williams, in a number of these guys. I mean, I think Abdul Bello probably stays inside, but again, he was a guy that was an offensive tackle. He's got some guys that can play tackle if they'll just listen and he can develop them. But I think of Ball, Kelly, and Jawan Williams, I think he can make the tackles a good bit better than they have been in terms of dealing with technicals, of being a technique-centered guy, and he is. Really focusing on that aspect, and that will make the whole offensive line look better. So I think that's the path to the offensive line getting turned around in 2019. And the bodies are there; they've got plenty of talent there. All right, I'm going to do a couple of quick ones, and then I will wrap this podcast. I've got about four more. I'm going to wrap this podcast because I'm starting to run late on time. I'm going to push a few that I've pushed for a while, still a little further. So the next podcast episode will probably be a mailbag as well. All right, let's see. Can you explain the various run schemes and the reasons coaches prefer one or the other? Wow, that is tough for a podcast. I'm actually going to push that question later. This is talking about gap versus zone and other things like that. I'm going to push that one a little bit further into the future. It's a really hard thing to deal with in terms of podcasting. I'll probably end up doing some stuff on YouTube or Facebook Live or something to address some of the schematic stuff, because it's just hard to do on a podcast. But yes, the answer is yes, I can. But again, it's harder to do. All right, next question from Doc D. Do you see Zaquandre White getting any touches this season? I know Cam and Patrick will be the top two backs, but I'm really excited about watching White work as well. And what do you think happens with Sheffield? So I think Sheffield continues to basically be decent depth. I don't think he's really going to see the field at the running back position because it's just too deep at this point. He might play a little bit more, move around a little bit in the slot, do some different things, and become a bit of a Swiss Army knife. I kind of expect that for him. But I'm not sure how much he really plays this year. I think he becomes a guy that in a year or two you get a little bit more from. I think White will probably see some touches. I just don't know how many touches there are going to be for White once, now that Patrick returned. How many extra touches are you going to get? Now, again, I've been told that Taggart is going to put three running backs on the field at once at different times this year. Put a running back in the slot, put two running backs in the backfield, or two running backs in the slot and one running back in the backfield, and run jet sweep action with one guy, run a little bit of read option with some action from the other, run some jet sweep action with one back coming in, coming out of the slot, and then running a lead play the other direction. There's all sorts of stuff that they're going to do with multiple running backs on the field, so you're going to see some opportunities for that third back a little bit more than you did for with Jimbo Fisher there. And White and LeBourne are going to have to fight really hard for that spot to get on the field as that third spot. They're also going to run some diamond formation, with the quarterback in the pistol. They'll do some of that stuff. So you'll see that third back getting some touches, but I'm just not sure how many there are going to be. But yeah, that's a good question. We'll see. I'm curious to see how the younger guys look in this offense in the spring as well. And I think that's a lot to be excited about. All right. Next question from Quentin Caldwell. From your podcast, I take it you weren't a big fan of Jimbo's fourth quarter program. What will the difference be in what Taggart's program is? I heard him refer to it as the chase, which sounds familiar or sounds similar. Yeah, there's some similarities. There's a lot of similarities between the chase and Jimbo's fourth quarter program, but there are a few things that Jimbo did that I never really liked. One is Jimbo moved the fourth quarter program from the early morning hours to the afternoon. And on the one hand, I agree with the logic there, which is we can work them just as hard, if not harder, and then it doesn't make them so tired that they can't focus in class. Yeah, I get that. But I actually kind of like, I mean, I went through mat drills multiple times. You know, I've gotten that t-shirt twice. The thing about mat drills is you're going to be up. You have to be there and be in line. You have to be exactly where you're supposed to be when the whistle blows at 5:45 in the morning. Now, if you have to come back for the double session, which I had to do at least once, I might have had to do it twice. I can't remember. I've kind of blocked that out of my head. It was pretty awful. But if you had to come back for a double session, then it's 4:45. But here's the thing. If you're having to get up at 5:45, you ain't out. You ain't out partying. You ain't out doing anything stupid at night. You're getting ready to get your butt kicked the next morning, and you're trying to get in bed a little earlier. So that actually has an extra sort of responsibility aspect to it that I think is helpful. And there's something to the shared camaraderie of everybody getting up at getting up dark and early. I remember one of our strength coaches used to say, "Man, anybody whoever said bright and early never really got up early." And when you get up dark and early like that, there's an additional team building component that was missing in the fourth quarter drills because they weren't then. They didn't happen in the early morning. I think another thing that the fourth quarter drills did, I never felt like they had the level of intensity in some regards that mat drills had. Where mat drills, the thing that really made mat drills more than anything else was the way that they divided everybody into units of four, basically. You had your lines and you were in your line. And if one guy in your line screwed up, everybody had to go back. And then if one guy in that line ultimately earned himself coming back the next day, then coming back for a double session, then everybody came back for a double session. And that kind of positive peer pressure is really, really helpful in terms of building a championship team. And I didn't really see any evidence of that in the fourth quarter program. Now, in terms of the drills that they do and different things, the Chase shares some things with the old mat drills, and it shares some things with some fourth quarter drills. So it's not exactly a return to old school mat drills, which I think actually would be behind the times. But I think from what I understand of the Chase, one of the things that they do in the Chase is that they divide guys up and they have them compete. You're putting two guys across from each other and having them compete on a race, on a shuttle run. You're having units that are selected. These guys are on your unit, and that unit is competing against that unit. And that stuff, that's really where I think a lot of this off-season conditioning stuff can really pay off beyond the conditioning side, beyond the physical side. It's the mental side that you're really working. And I felt like the last few Florida State teams were mentally fragile. They were not teams that, and I talked about this 2 months ago when Taggart got hired. They were, the Florida State teams of the last few years were not teams that came out and gave you the impression of walking out there with pride of, we've outworked you, you don't belong out here with us. To where they get behind or get in these situations, and you see that little bit of, and a lot of people would say swagger, but it's not swagger, it's pride. I worked too hard for this. We worked too hard for this, and that unity of having outworked the team that's across from you, I didn't see that attitude. And that's what you have to try to develop in this period in the Chase and do some of that stuff. We'll see whether or not it's successful, but you know, overall so far, you know, the returns are reasonably positive. We'll see what happens with that. Let's see. I'm going to rapid fire a few others. In your next pod, can you explain the difference between the boundary D end and the field D end? Yes, boundary D end is the bigger end. You might call that the strong side end. And the field D end is the more of the pass rusher, more the guy that you're going to get after the quarterback, a little bit of the twitchier type. I mean, again, think about Josh Kando could play either one, but again, you're looking at more of the pass rusher at the field end in the way that they're going to do this with Barnett's system. So that's what they're getting. It's a little bit of a difference in terms of size. You're looking at a little bulkier, not quite as twitchy guy for the boundary end, and the field end is the opposite. All right, next question. What happened to the level of scouting evaluation on the previous staff that allowed them to discover guys like Werner, Brooks, Freeman, Rhodes, and Irving? Did they get caught up in chasing star rankings instead of looking for real football players? I think, yes, that's part of it. I think that once you get success is a hard thing. Success is one of the biggest enemies of success. And when you get to the place where you can start to recruit according to your template, you may be willing to overlook guys that don't exactly fit that template. Yeah, maybe this 3-star looks, you know, if you're already getting 2 5-star five-star wide receivers, and then you see Jordan Young, who's nobody's really offered, and he's a 3-star and so on, do you stand pat on your 5-stars, or do you say, you know what, this kid actually may have a bigger ceiling than the 5-star that's on? No, you're going to go with the sure thing, the 5-star. But that 3-star that people hadn't noticed before might actually be the better player. And when you can't actually go after the bigger player or the kid that everybody knows about or whatever, you have to dig out some of those additional guys. And they did. The other thing, though, is that the staff that found all of the guys that you just listed, they were gone in 2013. Those six coaches left. It was a different staff. So, and I think it's very plain, very clear that James Coley and Mark Stoops and the rest of that staff, Eddie Gran, those guys did a better job in terms of evaluating and recruiting than the staff that Fisher replaced them with, which was more of a coaching staff. He chose a bunch of coaches rather than recruiters, and I think the results in that regard showed. And yes, I do think that they ended up going more for guys that fit their template, their mold, rather than necessarily focusing on finding football players. And again, they could afford to do that at that point. They had that luxury. And you have to be careful. You have to always go back to, is this kid, yeah, he might be a 4 or 5-star and he might have the height and weight that we want, but is he the football player that we want? That's just hard to do. Next question. How big a loss is Craig Kuligowski leaving Miami? A massive one. He might have been the best, he almost certainly was the best assistant coach on that staff. You can make a strong case that Kuligowski is the best defensive line coach in the country. And now he's at Alabama, so good luck, everybody. He might be the only defensive line coach, and again, he coaches the whole defensive line usually, but he might be the only defensive line coach that you would take over Odell Higgins at most places. Now, you wouldn't do it over Odell at Florida State because Odell is Florida State, but he's in that class as a D-line coach. And again, he can coach the whole D-line as well. That guy is a great coach. He's a really good recruiter. And he's a huge loss for Miami. Look at what their defensive line looked like this year as opposed to before he took over. All right. Final question for this podcast. And go ahead and those of you who have additional questions, or if there's questions that I have not answered, I may not have been able to get them down. Go ahead and send in your questions to the podcast. But this will be the final question for this podcast. From what I've seen of Taggart's offense, there's not much intermediate passing, just a lot of screens or bombs throwing it vertically. Do you think Walt Bell will help add that element to the mix? I fear against good defenses, Florida State will struggle unless they mix in some intermediate ball control passing. You are correct, sir. That's actually in the past. Taggart's offense has been basically either short stuff, quick game, screens, that sort of thing, or getting vertical with less in between. It's actually a pretty conservative approach when you're a run heavy team and you do a lot of screen game with some RPO stuff on the outside, or you know, your check with me's, that sort of thing on the outside. That stuff serves as your running game. And then when you're not running it, you are play action passing and trying to create big plays. And that's generally what he's done. Now, I agree with you that in the ACC against better defensive lines, against more talented defenses, you'd better be able to throw some intermediate pro level concepts as well, in addition to just either having some verticals or screens. But I think they'll be able to do that. I think one of the reasons that they didn't do as much in that intermediate area is because they didn't have the personnel to do it. And I think at Florida State, they will have the personnel, both at quarterback and elsewhere on the roster, to do a little bit more of that. I think they're going to end up looking a little bit more like Clemson in terms of having some of those intermediate options than they will, than they'll look like, say, Ole Miss or some of those teams that did a little bit more of a RPO heavy screen or vertical offense. I think they'll moderate that out. And yes, I do think Bell will have some impact on that with his experience in the past, where they've married some spread run concepts with pro passing concepts, like at North Carolina, for example, where they do that. I think you're going to see a lot of that. And again, I think they're going to have to do some of that. And they've got enough personnel that's used to doing that on the roster that you use that ability to learn that and that ability to execute that as a positive for your team. So again, short answer is yes, I do think they'll do more of that than they've done in the past, because again, at Florida State, you can do that. And I think Bell will be a factor in helping develop you only need two or three, four concepts that you can run in that intermediate area. And again, it's more risky when you throw in the intermediate area, and teams that throw a bunch generally have to do that more. But you need to have a few concepts that you can threaten teams with in that intermediate area to supplement what you've got downfield. But if you've got those burners outside and got guys that teams have to double team or keep help over the top to worry about, things get a lot easier, and they've been able to recruit that. And so that's going to make things fun to watch for the next few years. All right, well, that's going to do it for us here today on the Unconquered Podcast. Once again, this podcast is brought to you by Resolution Home Loans. If you have any needs for a mortgage or any sort of, or are considering any sort of real estate purchase in the near future, diehard Knowles, and they close with Seminole speed, you're going to want to go through their Almost Home program, which really sets them apart. They'll guarantee that you'll close within 15 days or the contract closing date, or they'll give you $500 off your closing costs. Give them a call at 844-FSU-LOAN or visit fsuhomeloans.com. Just let them know that you heard about them through the Unconquered Podcast, and you'll get some additional perks there. And also, if you wind up closing with them and after hearing about them through this podcast, let me know by tweeting your success story with the Unconquered Podcast hashtag. You can also email me with your success story, and I'll throw in a free item of your choice from the growing Unconquered Podcast shop. Once again, this has been the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all very much, and have a great day if you want to.
I made this.